today is the what we call the Uposatha day, where in monasteries throughout the world, monks and nuns come together and reflect on their rules of training, do recitation. So the three of us gathered together in Martha's Vineyard over here, and it's called Martha House actually. And we did, we made a little shrine, and we did some chanting, and then we did a confession together and a recitation. If there are four monks or four nuns, then it's quite a long recitation. It takes, one has to chant the entire rules of training, the Patimokkha, so it takes a good 45 minutes. But if there are only three or two monks, then it's a short recitation. But the point of it is that we try to do this every fortnight. I have to, even on my own, as a monk living with my mom, I try to reflect on that every fortnight. And what it is, it's a reflection of our training, of our aspiration, of our training, of our rules, of our commitment. It's very ritualized and formal, and it's a very, very powerful reminder of our lives, how to live it and why we're living in this particular non-conformist way. So imagine every fortnight for 30 plus years, just always remembering, reflecting on the commitment, on the rules of training, on the ethical principles, on the way a monastic should live his or her life. And the whole point of that is that when we take the robe, we in the chanting it said we go forth, it's called going forth, we go forth into the homeless life for the sake of realizing Nibbana, for the benefit of all beings. So it's very, it's a very privileged way to live one's life. It's the way it's, we've been discussing this little project called a monastery. Lots of good ideas, and Stephen too, because he's very skilled. But what the way the Buddhist monasticism evolved, it evolved in a culture which already had a tremendous sense of spiritual aspiration, and it had a great respect, and still does, for the renunciant, for the religious seeker, for the sadhu. And even still in India today, you see sadhus wandering about and receiving alms food, just because they are sadhus, just because they are renunciants, just because they are on a spiritual quest. Not because they're teachers, not because they give lottery numbers, you know, just because they're sadhus, just because they're doing that. And so I learned my sort of formal Buddhism in Thailand, where it was very interesting actually, because this ancient way of village life and monastic life, the interplay of that was still alive, it still is alive. Western consumerism hadn't quite overwhelmed that part of Thailand yet. And the teacher I was with, Lajin Cha, is very respected and had a very high standard of training and insight, and had very good contact with the lay villages around. And I saw a whole different cultural expression that I never saw in North America, and the monk or the nun, we cannot be hermits. We can't we have these rather odd rules where we can't be self-sufficient with finances or food. So the ritual we have at lunchtime where people offer food into our bowl is enacting the alms round that still takes place in, say, Thailand, where every morning at six, at sunrise, which is usually around six, we go out into the village, the lay people are waiting, and they offer us food, we go back to the monastery and we eat every day, every day, every day. And so in village life, so the village does its thing, the monastery does its thing, there's sort of two cultures running parallel, and they come together every now and then, every morning. So the villagers see the monks going through the village, and it's very serene, no schmoozing, it's to say the least. Eyes down, lay people put food in the bowl, and the monks just observe their bowls. In some places, monks would do a little chanting or blessing, but in our monasteries, we just quietly walk through. So every morning, in village life, there are the renunciants, the holy seekers, the religious seekers passing through the village. And in turn, the monastics see the lay people. They might already be out plowing the fields. I remember that walking on alms round, you'd see some really strong guy behind a water buffalo in mud up to his thighs. You know, really hard work. And then get to the village, you know, into the village, and his kids or his wife or someone would be giving us alms food. So for the monastic, that was very, very powerful to say that, well, I've got to earn this rice. These guys are working really hard. You know, I can't just sort of hang out and do nothing. I've got to put a lot of effort forth. So it's this lovely, beautiful cultural relationship of spiritual aspiration, always evident in the culture, always apparent. This is going on. And so the lay people would come to the monastery and participate in various ways, and the monks would go to the village if someone died. And so in our monastery, we'd go to the village, to the home, and we'd do chanting, and there'd be some teaching around death, and then the body would be, 2 days later, would be brought back to the monastery. We had an open funeral pyre, two concrete plinths, in which you could put the firewood, and then the body was placed on top of that. All the villagers would come for a public burning, open pyre. So it's kind of life of the village and life of the monastery in a very beautiful way, again, coming together and then going apart again. And what was really, of the many things that was inspiring about that was that the highest thing in that culture, the highest aspiration was the spiritual seeker, was the realization of Nibbana. That was held the highest. And I went once to Bangkok to a conference, and we had one of these large receptions with the King of Thailand, and his teacher, the King of Thailand had been a monk, and his teacher was in the front row, and the King of Thailand came and knelt to the monk, and in a beautiful, soft and humble way. It's just lovely to see. And the monk held his hand, and they had a little chat, and it was really, really very touching. Of course, Thailand has all kinds of corruption and problems, so it's pretty wacky in many, many ways. But you know that. But there, and there's a vein in that culture that there is a spiritual goal. And that beings are aspiring to that, and that's to be honored and praised. And really, it was extraordinary how the lay people never asked anything of me. Every now and then, you know, they'd say, "Why don't you give us a Dhamma talk or something?" I could kind of struggle with my Thai, but there was never any demand or expectation. It was just this, go for it. You know, if you want to go for it, do it. It's really very pure. The giving was very, very pure in that way. And then from that, you have some of the monastics, very few would stay for a lifetime. Most would leave. Like I ordained with 17 men, and within a year, half had disrobed. And I'm one of two left now. But they were all Thais. I was the only Westerner at that time in that group. So it's quite common in Thailand, at least, for people to ordain and then disrobe again. It's quite an honorable thing to do it for a period of time. If you don't get many lifers. but because it's such a big system, there's plenty of monastics that stay for life. The nuns' orders died out in Theravada Buddhism with the Muslim invasions of, I think that was the last of it in the 11th century, and they're only now really being revived in a strong way. In Korea they survived, in Taiwan they survived, so the Korean and the Chinese in Taiwan, their nuns' orders are much more powerful, much more intact, much more, the training is much more continuous. But, so it's interesting, you know, coming in Eastern Ontario and doing our little number in Martha's house there. It's really lovely. It's this tradition, as Ajahn Khusla was saying, it's very portable. We had a calligraphy of Buddha. We didn't even have a Buddha image. We have a calendar. We used that, pop that up. It's got the Mon. Mon is a kind of Thai alphabet, calligraphic form for Butto. We used that as the image. Three candles, two, three. We're not proud. We use three. And there's your shrine. And bow, and then do the chant. And so it's a kind of tradition which is... It has a great life to it. It seems very cultural, but actually it has a great vitality to it. We are non-conformists, and yet we've got the same outfit. You know, this is quite interesting that into the consumer culture we just, what are you guys at? Well, we're really non-conformists. I get more looks at me than beautiful women do to my outfit. it's very odd. And yet we are conformist, aren't we? Because we're abiding by the same rule. And it's interesting that in monastic life, self-expression is not important. Self-realization is, but self-expression is, that's not terribly important. So everyone brings something to monastic life, their own gifts, their own challenges, their own, you know, sensitivities and so on. But when the sense of a self being expressed in very individualistic ways, that's, if someone does that, they just look odd. You know, what's your problem? So that's very counterculture, isn't it? You know, if you think about what Western democracy has gone to a lot, it's like every individual's opinion is of equal value. The student has just as much power as the teacher. You know, strange, strange values. So individualism and individual expression and individual tastes are very, very important. But if that is believed in, of course, then that's a very sad state of affairs. It's very external. It's very, very superficial, isn't it? So our life is based upon, first of all, it's based upon the aspiration to realize Nibbana. Because a life lived for community in and of itself would be absurd, because a community cannot realize Nibbana. So it is about individual realization. It can only be that. You can't have some kind of communist system where you have some goal that the community has, because we're individuals. But that realization is facilitated through a training. So when we go forth, when we take the robe, we use the word the English word ordination, but that always smacks to me of a priesthood. You know, like I'm somehow, I've got the goods. If you want to get to Nibbana, you got to come through me, right? But we're not priests. We're simply practitioners, as you are. But we take up the training. So it's called picking up the training. And when someone disrobes, they simply say, "I disavow the training. I'm putting the training down." Simple. And so the training is a way of living. It is a way of relating. It's a system of rules and laws and etiquettes. Not just meditation. It's not just about, you know, watching your breath. It's a whole lifestyle. Sharing communal property, renunciation, celibacy, contentment with little, sense restraint. So we have these very very powerful basics to our life, very powerful basic kind of considerations and reflections that we train with. So as I was, what did I say earlier? I think I talked about contentment, maybe? Say, like contentment with little is a training that we try to do. So again, I keep coming back to this, I know, but the reflective mind, as opposed to the kind of absolutist doctrinaire mind, contentment with little. If I was just heavy on myself, I said, "Viradhamma, you should be content with little." And now there you go again, you want another bun. Whatever it is. Which is just, that's position taking and ego, isn't it? Whereas as a reflection is, okay, the Buddha said that the spiritual life is based on contentment with little. Now that has to come from right understanding. And what is right understanding? Well, right understanding is that in the sense world, you won't find nibbana. You won't find liberation in objects, right? So you kind of sense, yeah, I know it can't be in greed or desire. So it has to be something, I have to stay home. And if I'm always out and discontent, wanting more and all of that, well, then that's not going to be it. Okay, so contentment makes sense to me. So you have to pick up the training with right understanding rather than just with some viewpoint. This is what a Buddhist monk does. So then we're trained to be content with alms food. Good enough for the day. Just one meal a day, breakfast, lunch, one meal a day, whatever. Enough for the day to keep the body going. A hut to live in, to protect me from the weather, from the climate. Clothing, good enough to sort of look like a monk and stay warm, etc. And medicine. So we have these four requisites we reflect upon. Now that doesn't mean that I'm content, right? Now, I wasn't content when I started, and sometimes I'm not content now. But the reflection is, discontent is not something that I should invest in. Yeah? If I just say I should be content, then that's that awful mind. It is, I should be this or that. But that's not reflection. Reflection is contentment with little is a foundation for enlightenment. Okay, and so then I'm doing what I'm doing. I have my food in front of me. I'm reflecting on it. So in Thailand, I had a lot of problems with food because I was quite habituated to fancy foods of all kinds and all sorts and at all times, of course. And then all of a sudden it was one a day, you know, once a day, food, and then it wasn't what I was used to. Sticky rice, you know, a few kind of ghastly curries, and that was it. So the discontent mind certainly came up, and, you know, it came up big time. But then the reflection, well, why are you here? You came for the meal? Yeah. And certainly the greed could be quite furious sometimes and adamant, but the reflection is, you know, and constantly reflecting, contentment with little is the basis for nibbana. So then the discontent has a mirror, right? And that mirror then awakes me to, oh, this is the feeling of discontent, and I come back to awareness. Now if I just believe that I shouldn't be discontent, then of course it gets repressive, and then I kind of do it for a while, and I'm really, really ascetic, and I don't have a second bun, and I won't complain, I really like it here, and I leave. Because you can't live that way. So a repressive monastic life is a disaster for the monastic and everyone else. So contentment with little is a training to be done. And you can see how if I'm willing to undertake that training, even if I'm a layperson, and I do that, if I'm a layperson, I have to kind of figure that out for myself in the complexity of lay life. But if I use that as a training, and I do that all the time, then I've got this lovely way of looking at discontent. And it doesn't just have to be around food. It can be around weather or whatever you want, more complex things. But I create standards of reflection, standards of contemplation, which then begin to inform my view of life, the way I operate, my habits, and they begin to awaken me to principles that are foundations for enlightenment. Right? And that's possible. That's possible. Being content like that, it's not human. We're just not made that way. Right? And then I train. Wherever my discontent is, that's what I train with. I think most monastics go through kind of the severe ascetic phase, you know, where they, you know, I don't want that, I don't want that. And they can be quite sort of marine-like, not as an animal, but as a military sort of, you know, kind of tough, well, I know I did. And I think about it, it's rather embarrassing. But so, you know, one just tries to, you know, not have desire, not have lust, and just be really tough, but that's not reflective. That's not contemplative. It's, again, ego. I'm someone that shouldn't have this. Whereas the contemplative mind begins to see that awareness can take it all. Awareness is fine. Just have to remember. Right? You just have to remember, not fall habits. Another part of our training is sense restraint. This is very difficult in urban culture or whatever, but we just don't have access in monasteries to Larry King. We just don't have access to a lot of sense stimulation, and that is really very frustrating. I found it very frustrating in the beginning, but then as I just use that, it's obviously very calming. Very calming. And that's what we have here. We have kind of built-in sense restraint. We practice noble silence. We don't have access to audio things or video things, and we're not kind of sharing a lot of personal stories. So it's not normal life. Obviously, we can't live this way all the time. But it does kind of show you how sense stimulation, how much it stirs up the mind. Also, maybe perhaps we see that there are some things which we maybe really would like to get into, especially the sort of early day, the first 2-3 days or something, and we don't have that. We feel restless, not having those avenues of stimulation. But if one just reflects and just bears witness to that with patience, then the mind begins to have a kind of settled quality because it's not being stirred all the time. So one begins to see the kind of value of sense restraint. And you know, monasteries are kind of meant, like I said at the beginning, this Tisarana, its motto will be nothing happening. It's the nothing happening monastery, where you can just be. You can just kind of, we have to build it first and foremost. But you know, like I guess we all find that in Gatineau or wherever we go, where you just be, you know. doing all kinds of things. And then sense experience becomes different, doesn't it? You know, like the space of the river, or the kind of dome of the sky, or the sound of the wind. It doesn't have that same kind of jarring quality or stimulating quality. It has a kind of, you get more calmed by it. The communal nature of our life is something that is, I see it more and more as an art form or a craft. It's not something you can pick up from books. And I was fortunate to come into a culture where there was this fabulous teacher who was very charismatic, very gifted, and really understood his own power. Very powerful man. Understood his power in society. And understood the life form that he was living, and could translate that to men and women who wanted to practice with him. It was very fortunate. I thought how fortunate I was to kind of be inducted into this life in a way which was so whole. You know, it was like here, like as monastics in the West, just these kind of oddballs trying to survive. You know, you don't really get a sense of the whole momentum of a Buddhist culture, but there it was like how powerful. George Sharp, one of our trustees in England, said Ajahn Chah was like a shogun, you know, but in a really, really good way, because he was a very powerful individual even before he became a monastic, very charismatic. He was always sort of the best at whatever he did. As a child, in kids' games in Thailand, they don't play cowboys and Indians, they play monk. Because, you know, who's the big shot in the community? It's the monk. And, of course, who was the Ajahn? It was Ajahn Chah. So he was already directing the little guys around as a five-year-old. That's what they say. But here was a man that used all those gifts for the liberation from suffering. And that was very... Because in that part of Thailand, it's a very poor part of Thailand, you know, the kind of, really, the Wayne Gretzky's of that culture were the big forest monks. They were the superstars. So the you know, a lot of the young men who went into the robe, that was their aspiration, to be a Wayne Gretzky, but an Ajahn Chah or a Ajahn Mun or whatever. So that kind of powerful energy that young men have was really directed to, for many men, in a very, very skillful way, towards Nibbana. And from those times, a lot of very good teachers came. So you have a kind of culture that I think Ajahn Jayasaro said, how do you measure the wealth of a culture? You measure it as GDP or GNP or how many televisions everyone has. What if you measured it as how many arahants there are per square kilometer? And then he said the northeast of Thailand is a superpower. Because that area of Thailand just produced so many interesting and powerful spiritual teachers. It's a very, very interesting part of the world. But anyway, for me, from that time, I think, because I've always had a sort of sense of social activism, I have a kind of altruistic streak in me. And from seeing that culture, I think I intuited this sense that the way one can serve culture is in a grassroots way, is by creating spiritual communities. Where the spiritual values of renunciation and aspiration are held foremost, are upheld, and are applauded, and opportunities for spiritual practice are encouraged, either for ordination or for practicing in whatever retreats or whatever. And so, this monastery which we're dreaming and scheming about now is that's really what I would hope it would be. It would be a place that the monk and nun, they are archetypes. There's one Armando Panica, he said that not everyone has the vocation to be a monk or a nun, but everyone, he said everyone, I think he did, everyone has that aspiration of the monk or the nun, right? So when culture has no, when everything's kind of dumbed down and everyone dresses the same, then conformity becomes peer group pressure. Do what everyone else does. And the symbols of religious aspiration, where do you find them? In Ottawa? In the church? A few Catholic churches are open, most are locked. Do you see them on billboards? Or do you hear it on the radio? I guess Ideas sometimes has something, Trap Tapestry and CBC. But just in any culture, there are a certain proportion of people who are spiritually mature and are aspiring to whatever liberation is about, and it's a shame when that gets lost. So the idea of a monastic in society, Najan Chah said, wear your robe, that's your flag. It's like an archetype. And people don't understand me as an archetype. They think I'm a transvestite sometimes. Or something. But I'm working on it. More and more now. I think the Dalai Lama helps a lot. It's really helpful. But to have that, to have those reminders in culture seems to me very important. Seems to give culture a kind of a very necessary tone that can get so lost in all the kind of consumerism. But so to kind of just contemplate this whole the Buddhist path as not just kind of watching your breath, right? But how can I use this life as a training, right? How can the things that I do, the relationships I have, the work situations I'm in, how can I train in mindfulness? How can I train in ways that awaken the mind? How can I train in ways that help other beings on the path? And it is certainly difficult in competitive offices or situations which are essentially very, very distracting, but to keep that aspiration foremost in the heart is important, because I think that's what really fulfills us, isn't it? I think if we don't honor that, then we feel somehow we've not honored our own truth. The Dhamma is truth, isn't it? The truth of the way things are. And so aspiration is an important part of the way we aim ourselves. In Buddhism, we talk about letting go of desire, and that's stupid desire. But aspiration is like wise desire. And we all aspire to be free from greed, free from hatred, free from delusion, to be more compassionate. That is a good aspiration. That is a good aspiration. The question is, how do you do it? Right? That's where right understanding comes in. Once you have a sense of right understanding, then you get right thought and all the rest of it going on. So in the the Four Noble Truths, I talked about the four truths. So there's the noble truth of suffering, noble truth of cause of suffering, noble truth of the cessation of suffering, noble truth of the path leading to cessation of suffering. Then I talked about understanding suffering, abandoning the cause, which is craving, attachment to craving, abandonment, Then there's the cessation, noticing the end of suffering, noticing the end of craving, so realization. And then there's the development of the path. And the final bit in that, because it's a 12-factor thing, and the Buddha said, this is the way the Buddha's enlightenment is described, there is the understanding of suffering. There is the suffering has been understood. The cause has been abandoned. Cessation has been realized. And the path has been developed. Now, when you read that, you think, okay, that's some time in the future. But is it? If you kind of leave it in the future, how do you reflect on it? But in the moment, you really understand that suffering is caused by attachment to craving, and you let go. That's it. You've understood suffering. You've abandoned the cause. You've seen it. You've noticed and realized the cessation, and you've developed a path. That's the path. And that's where you get your confidence. That's it. Right there. And be confident in that. Just that's it. And then the doubting mind says, well, that little voice, I couldn't be enlightened. Not me. I just started. But why not? You know, why wait? This is the end of suffering. Yeah. It's understood. Just abandon craving, yeah. Because Buddha's teaching like in liberation, enlightenment, sounds so far away, you know, and I'm just like, you know, barely made it on the cushion today. But right in that moment, any moment, this is suffering, this is cause. So you keep coming back. So it's a very immediate teaching. It's very immediate. And that's what the training is. It's not a training to become. It's a training to remember. Again and again and again. Not to become. All right. I'll leave that for your reflection.
Nam namayang dhamma vargata sadhu karang dhamase sadhu sadhu.